Business Matters, in association with Donegal ETBs for their education and training service, developing the Donegal workforce in one of the most critical and fundamental digital skills of our time through its spreadsheet programmes.
Hi, I'm Kieran O'Donnell. Welcome to Business Matters. My guest this week is pharmacist Tom Murray, who opened his first pharmacy in Remelton in 2001. He has since opened chemists in Castlefin and Convoy. Born in Coventry to Irish parents, Tom moved to Ireland in the 1990s and worked as manager with the Lloyds and Boots companies before becoming a community pharmacist, which had always been his ambition. Tom is a member of the Pharmacy Contractors Committee, IPU, and heads up the Donegal branch of Border Communities Against Brexit. Tom began by explaining how he ended up becoming self-employed in Donegal.
I was always coming home to Ireland throughout my whole childhood, so my father's Mayo, my mother's Galway. I moved back home when I was 26. I was living in Athlone. I came to Donegal town on holiday, fell in love with the place, got a job in Donegal town.
What year is that, Tom?
That was the year 1999-2000. And then an opportunity to come up. United Drug came to see me in Donegal town and said there was a pharmacy going for sale in Donegal. And would I be interested in running it, because I was young and they thought they'd have a good customer for life. They backed me. I went to Ulster Bank. Peter Smith, who I knew fairly well at the time, wrote a letter of personal recommendation, I think because we were both Celtic fans, spoke a bit of Irish, mad about the GAA, and that was it. I suppose lucid days in the banking industry back then, but because of Peter Smith, I got a loan and didn't sleep for the next number of months, but we started out in 2001, 1st of November 2001.
So going back and the run-on to that period where you qualified as a pharmacist, was that something you had always aspired to be?
Yeah, I think I'd always aspired to work for myself. I think that's something I'd learned from my father, who was a subby in England and worked for himself. And I think also just, yeah, I always had a notion of just being self-employed. I was working for a large pharmacy chain in England, Lloyd's Pharmacy. When I first moved home, I was a manager for Boots and I was on the regional management and strategy team for the whole island of Ireland. But it was always my aspiration that I'd find some way out on my own.
I'm sure that experience with Boots stood you in good stead.
It did. I mean, it taught you a few things about economics, and it taught you a few things about how to manage your business and performances within the business. But maybe it was too structured for me as well. There was a lot of information for information's sake at time. There was a lot of reports that had to be done. There was a lot of rules and regulations. I have no disrespect. Boots are a great company, as were Lloyd's. But I always felt a wee bit distanced from the community because they're so big. I always wanted to be central to a community and felt that's a far more important thing to be in community pharmacy.
You weren't tempted to follow your fella's footsteps in the subcontracting game?
I was extremely tempted, but he wouldn't let me. I used to work on the buildings every summer from my childhood, and when I was 16, I gave up school. I said, Daddy, I'm not going back to school, because I was loving that summer. I was working with my dad, my uncles, friends, getting a bit of strength, a few euros in the back pocket, or pounds at the time. The sun was beating off the rocks. And my dad said, I've no work for you, son, go back to school until December. And then in December, he took me up to the M6 motorway outside Coventry and he gave me a pick and a shovel and he kept me there for 2 weeks breaking concrete at -3, -4, -5. By the end of the 2 weeks, I was crying to get back to school. And his quote to me was, he didn't kill himself like a dog on the streets of England for me to do the same thing, go back to school and find a better way in life. And do you know what? It was a 4 month trick that he played on me from September right through to December, but by God, it taught me a lesson.
There was a method in his madness, though.
There was a method in his madness. He was a cute man.
So did you apply yourself very much then to the books, to academic?
I kind of had always done a bit of both. I'd always been in, I wouldn't say I was a great guy at school. I was always a bit of a rogue, but I was lucky enough that I could get through. Then I had to kind of knuckle down. I remember in the February of my A-levels, I got an ungradable mark in maths, and I was actually doing maths and advanced maths because maths was my strongest subject, so I had kind of swung the lead for a while. So from February until June, I worked like hell to get up and get the grades that was required to go and do pharmacy.
So fast-tracking to when Peter Smith gave you the go-ahead for the loan, that was a major moment for you in your business life?
I think probably the scariest 3 or 4 months of my life. I was working the first year probably on average 80 hours a week. Thought I had to do everything, and never slept for months and months and months because with young kids, but that wasn't it. I just didn't think I'd ever be able to repay the loans. And I suppose after a few months of you pay a loan, you pay a loan, you get a little bit more comfortable with it, you start to see where the business is going. And yeah, it was a hairy time, but it was a time when you just had to be committed to what you'd chosen to do. You'd backed yourself, so you had to back yourself to the hilt.
Yeah, and it was here in the pharmacy in Remelton, was your first one?
It was in Remelton, yeah, I started off, yeah. Yeah.
And looking back on those 20 years, what are your views now?
I'm still delighted I did it. I absolutely love Remelton. I love the three towns I'm in, but I mean, Remelton's my home. The one thing I will say is I remember my first night in Remelton. We used to live in the flat above the shop, and there was a knock on the door, and a young lad called Shamie Boyce was running Conway's Bar at the time. He knocked, he goes, "Are you the new chemist, man?" I said, "I think I am, yeah." He says, "Right, so there's a pint waiting for you at 7 o'clock. Come over and meet the locals." And it was like, you know, you were home within the first day. Remelton's got a great community spirit that way. Looking back over the 20 years, I'd say the biggest lessons I learnt was don't think you can actually do everything, don't think you have to do everything, and realise the best thing you can do is surround people around you who are better at what they do than what you are. The very first year, I thought I had to do everything. I ordered all the stock for the front of shop, I ordered all the stock for the dispensary. The Christmas lines came in and we were still looking at them the following Easter, and I thought, Tom, you haven't a clue how to buy for the front of shop. Maggie Cullion, she's now Maggie Dernion, who was 17 at the time, had started working here as a Saturday girl. Within a few weeks she was full time, and that Christmas I said, look Maggie, from now on you do all the front of shop ordering and don't let me go near it. And 19 years later Maggie still does most of the shop ordering in the front, and I'm not allowed near any reps in the front of the shop.
So it's the importance of delegation, is that what you're telling me?
It's important to delegation and recognising that if there's other people who are better at what they do than you can be, let them do it.
Is that your ethos? That's your philosophy?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, there's no hierarchy in here unless there absolutely has to be. If there has to be a responsibility call, then I will make it. But in reality, we work more like a cooperative. Every single person's idea has parity, and every single idea is welcome. I mean, like at one stage, I was the vice chair, the National Committee for the Pharmacy Union, the Pharmacy Contractors Committee, and it was at a time when pharmacy and Mary Harney was the Minister for Health at the time, we weren't getting on very well. So I was actually in Dublin nearly 3 or 4 days a week. But before I took that role, I was very much of the opinion, it says Tom Murray outside the door, this is about Tom Murray, I've got to be here. And Tara Jacob, at the time, Tara Sims, now took over as the supervising pharmacist here. And the business grew in my absence. And I was thinking, okay, that's a great lesson to learn and a great kick to the ego. You had to leave your ego at home when you realise somebody does a job better than you. So I've always trusted the people who work with me. I'm extremely lucky that in all three shops, I've got a great team. I've got a fantastic team who will call a spade. They'll tell me if I'm doing right. They'll tell me if I'm doing wrong. They'll advise you. They'll question. They'll come up with their opinions. And we get on very well. I mean, we have a very relaxed atmosphere, but that helps because it means people can say what they want to say.
How many years in your team overall, Tom, and when did you make the decision to open up the other two branches?
There's 19 of us all together. 2005, I opened the pharmacy in Castlefin. I was doing my diploma in the Irish language in the University of Ulster in McGee. And I was asked by two of the people who were there studying with me, they said, would you ever think about opening a pharmacy in Castlefin? So I looked at it and we opened then. And then we bought Convoy in 2016. There was a bit of a gap in between the two times, I suppose, when the recession happened and different things, and it was more about consolidation, and I suppose my kids were growing up and we were busy and probably could have expanded more, but I'm happy that I'm comfortable where I am at the minute.
How different was it to have three as opposed to one?
To be honest, not hugely. There's a couple of things that I do. The first thing is our systems are very good. We've SOPs to beat the band, so everything is very, very, very well organised. And within the teams, you can recognise the people who are the organisers, the people who are the planners, the people who are the doers, the people who are the thinkers. So the shops kind of run themselves, the three pharmacies. It does give you a bit more buying power. It does give you a little bit more margin. It does give you a little bit more volume. But in terms of running, other than, I mean, there is an extra responsibility. And I suppose if you've got personnel issues in one shop, you have them in the three shops. There is that bit. But again, we don't have an awful lot of them. I'm extremely lucky at how well the people who work with me get on with each other. and how well they get on with me and I get on with them. So I can't honestly say it was a huge headache to go from 1 to 2 or 2 to 3.
Okay. You're no stranger to the waves of Highland Radio, Tom. You've articulated your views on Brexit and more recently in relation to the vaccine and COVID-19. I suppose we'll start with the vaccine and roll it and COVID-19. What is your view of things at the minute as they stand now?
I think there's two things to it. I think that obviously the vaccine is extremely important, but I think people shouldn't see the vaccine as a silver bullet cure for all. It's still going to take 8, 9, 10 months for us to get enough people vaccinated for it to have an impact on how we live our lives. And I think it's very important that people don't get COVID weary, which I think happened before Christmas. We're 11 months into our first lockdown, if you take it, or rolling lockdowns. It started on the 15th of March last year. We're coming up to 11 months now. Everybody's fatigued, everybody's tired, everybody's struggling, but this is the time when we have to keep going. I've been vaccinated because of my work with a nursing home. I haven't changed my behaviour, and I won't be changing my behaviour. It's as simple as this. Nobody is safe till everybody is safe. As pharmacists, we have massive experience of vaccinating. I've been doing flu vaccines for years and years and years, of all age groups. In particular, there were some challenges in the last year because of COVID and the social distancing that required and things. And so we had an appointment basis rather than a walk-in clinic. But I think we've demonstrated that we can do the vaccine program for all ages, safely, professionally, appropriately. And I think we're looking forward to doing that. I do hope that we will be starting with the AstraZeneca vaccine within the next 3 to 4 weeks. That will be dependent upon vaccine supplies. The vaccine is absolutely crucial, but it's equally crucial that people don't change their behaviour just because some people have been vaccinated, or indeed because they themselves have been vaccinated. We have to take the nobody's safe till everybody's safe approach. It's not fair if somebody gets vaccinated to amend their behaviour and put somebody else at risk, simply because we don't yet know, does the vaccine reduce transmissibility? There is some evidence coming that it roughly reduces transmissibility by 15%, but that still means there's a half a chance I could give you COVID if I've been vaccinated. You know, it doesn't say there's no chance I can give you COVID.
You're well placed in the community to see how it has played out. Over the 11 months, you know, there have been different stages of the virus, and it's had a severe impact on the communities that you work in, Tom.
I think there's been social, cultural and business impacts. Obviously, the business impacts are easy to see. There's closed doors everywhere. There's closed doors all over Letterkenny. There's closed doors in every town in Donegal. And there are people who are seriously, seriously struggling economically because of that. And there are some people who probably don't know if they'll have the stomach or the appetite to come back into business. There are some people who financially may not be able to. But I think, as well as that, though, culturally, we as a people have had to change. I mean, Irish people were always normally so tactile and affectionate. And, you know, if you go out and you meet a lad in a pub, you nearly always slap each other on the back, or you shake hands, or people hug. And it's really quite depressing to see the lack of hugging and cuddles that between families and friends. And I think that's been really, really difficult for everyone. And I think socially, it's been a huge, huge challenge. And I think when this thing started and the COVID numbers were going up, there were numbers. They were being read out in Dublin, in RTE, and it was numbers that were there. Then the numbers came home and they became numbers in Donegal. And then they became people we knew, or they became family members of people we knew. And then, like, I don't know anybody that doesn't know somebody who's been seriously ill with COVID at this stage, or unfortunately has lost their life with COVID. It's just too common, it's too local. Do you know, I remember doing an interview with Greg Hughes a few weeks ago, and I was talking about my view of an all-island policy and pursuing zero COVID. It's really hard to imagine that in 10 months, more people have died on the island of Ireland than 30 years of the Troubles. On that morning that I did the interview, we were at 5,641 deaths on the island in 10 months. That's a lot more than died in the entire 30 years of the Troubles. So COVID has radically changed society. Please God, we'll get back to where we were. Please God, we'll go back to our natural behaviours. But we can't afford to take risks or to get sloppy or to weaken our resolve now when it's killing that many people.
How well do you think the government has handled the challenges of COVID, and in particular the rollout now of the vaccine?
I think the government have had a very difficult job to do between the scientific evidence of NPHET, the business requirements, the cultural requirements of society. I don't think opening up before Christmas was the wisest plan. I think that we sacrificed a lot to have Christmas Day. And I think we saw that play out in January, February. But I don't think anyone was expecting the spikes and the rises to be as fast, because we weren't expecting the British strain to come on and be as infective as it is. We weren't expecting the South African strain to come into the country and be as infective as... And those two strains have hugely increased the infectivity rate. So they caught everybody by surprise. In terms of the vaccine rollout, I think the most important thing is that the vaccine rollout is a living document, and that it changes and that it adapts to the needs. Obviously, we're at the mercy of supply. I don't agree with the decision not to allow pharmacists to vaccinate the over 70s, because we've demonstrated it. I think that what's most important now is that GPs and pharmacists, who together between September and December vaccinated 1.7 million people with the flu vaccine, working together, I think we need to be allowed to get at that as soon as possible and roll out the vaccine as fast as possible. Yes, following the protocols devised by NIAC and by NEFET, but where they can't be adhered to have flexibility to allow the vaccine to be administered as fast as possible to as many as possible.
I know you met with the Rectors members along with fellow pharmacists Rory O'Donnell and James Kesty. What is the logic in relation to the government not allowing pharmacists to administer the vaccine to over 70s?
I'm not quite sure, and there's no clinical basis for it.
Right. And how frustrating and disappointing is that for you?
It's pretty frustrating and disappointing. I mean, it is based upon the requirements, the storage requirements for the Pfizer-BioNTech vaccine and the Moderna vaccine. Having said that, I don't think it's any easier to supply that to a rural GP than it is to a rural pharmacy. There isn't actually clinical basis for us not being able to do it. It's a decision that was taken. We have to accept that decision. It is frustrating. I do think, actually, that the clinical evidence around the AstraZeneca and the over 65 and 70s, I expect that to change in the next number of weeks. And the reason I'll say that is for this. What happened in the trials with AstraZeneca, with the Pfizer vaccine and the over 65s, was that age cohort came late to the trial. So two things are measured in the trial. First of all is an antibody response that's generated within a short period after getting the vaccine. And the second thing is 3 months after you've had the vaccine, how many of the population got COVID, and that's how they work out the effectiveness. In the antibody trials, the over 65s generated roughly the same amount of antibodies as the 45 to 55 age group. Therefore, you could predict that it's going to be as effective, but until the clinical trial is finished, NIAC has to follow science and has to be very, very diligent about science. It can't let politics or the media dictate. So NIAC can't say that the AstraZeneca is appropriate in the over 65s until the clinical trial is finished. Having said that, they can hint that there's an expectation that it will be as effective in that age group as it is in all other age groups. And I think that information will come out within the next 3 to 4 weeks. And I think from then you probably will see a change in mind in the government, and that the AstraZeneca vaccine will then be used, because it's much easier, it's much more stable, it can be stored in a fridge for longer periods of time. It doesn't have the same infrastructural requirements as the Pfizer-BioNTech and Moderna vaccine.
And there we'll take a break.
Business Matters, in association with Donegal ETBs for their education and training service, providing a wide range of training from QQI levels 1 to 6 to support Donegal businesses large and small.
Before the break, Tom spoke about the effectiveness of the COVID-19 vaccines currently being administered.
Best case scenario, Tom, when do you see the vast majority of the population being vaccinated?
I think we'll be lucky. If you look at the government plan, it was always that by the autumn time, we'd be at the majority of people. And I think if we're lucky, we'll be there by autumn, to be honest. I think there's been a few delays, there's been a few changes so far, and it doesn't take much delay for there to be a serious delay. We had that issue between the EU and AstraZeneca, which was a delay which, for a number of days or weeks, that has been kind of resolved. There was a fire in one of the Pfizer plants, I think, in India, which is the largest vaccine producing plant in the world. That reduced stocks. We're at the mercy of supply, but I think people need to understand this is another long haul. I don't think we'll be out of this. Late autumn, early winter next year, we'll be lucky.
Switching to Brexit, that's an issue that you have strong views on.
Very strong views on. I suppose I've been a Donegal spokesperson for Border Communities Against Brexit now for 4 years.
just sorry, Tom, how did that come about, or how did that come about to be established?
What happened was myself and a few other people from different cultural backgrounds and different business backgrounds on both sides of the border, who had expressed opinions, I suppose, about leading up to Brexit, were put in contact with each other, and we formed BCAB in, we met in Omagh, or just outside Omagh, 4 years ago, and we decided we would form a campaign group that contains people from every background and cultural expression, north and south. So we had nationalists, we had unionists, we had business people, we had farmers, we have employees, we have employers. And it was all people who lived on either side of the border who recognised at the time there was a serious threat of a hard border on the island of Ireland. For me personally, my thing was a hard border on the island of Ireland damaged the integration that we've developed for the last 30 years. It massively damaged the economic development that we've seen since the Good Friday Agreement. But more importantly than anything else, it was a threat to the Irish peace process. My drive and passion to get involved in BCAB was and always will be primarily protect the peace process. And I've been passionately advocating for that since. We've had some great success. I remember I was sitting in Guy Verhofstadt's office in Brussels the day that Boris Johnson signed the Irish Protocol. And I remember the two of us kind of just expressing a huge sigh of relief, because we knew at that stage there would be no hard border in Ireland. We knew at that stage the border was gone to really where it needs to be, which is somewhere down the Irish Sea. It's not perfect. There's no such thing as a good Brexit. There's still a lot of challenges business-wise. We've seen that over the last few weeks with imports and with paperwork and different things and some of the shop shelves empty. But for me, we kept the border open. So the number of border crossings every day is phenomenal. The number of families who live and work on either side of the border, the number of families who have family members on both sides of the border, there's kids who go to school in the north and live in the south and vice versa. There's doctor services on either side of the border. The levels of integration in this area, all along the border, right the way from Louth to Derry, is phenomenal. There's absolutely no way we could countenance going back to a hard border. So I'm delighted we protected that, if we did nothing else. And it gave us a great opportunity. We've met some amazing people.
Are you surprised that there are problems post-Brexit trade between Northern Ireland and Great Britain now?
No, I'm not. I'm sadly not surprised. I think one of the things the British government seemed to do was take an ostrich approach. They're wonderful at creating problems but not acknowledging they created the problems. They were wonderful at ignoring the problems they created. Look, if you read the Irish Protocol, which I did do at the time that it was signed, I remember actually sitting and I was sitting in an MEP's office in Brussels, and Greg Hughes rang me and Raid Nagelta rang me for two interviews. And I've literally just got the document and I spent the day reading the document. There are issues there, but there are issues there that were forecast from last October. And, you know, if you think about it, from the Brexit actually happened the 31st of January last year, not this year. It didn't happen on the 31st of December this year. That was supposed to be the washout period, the learning period. And we didn't start the learning period till maybe the 31st of January this year, which indicates exactly where the mindset has been of those Brexiteers. They didn't evolve. They didn't recognise the difficulties. And they have put themselves and people in this island economically in difficulty because of that. It doesn't surprise me, sadly.
When you're not working and you're not talking about Brexit and you're not negotiating for the pharmacist, I know you have a big interest in sport and culture.
I have a huge interest in the Irish language. My father was a Gaelgor. He was from the Gaeltacht in northwest Mayo. I'm passionate about the Irish language and Irish language services. I'm hugely passionate about the GAA. I've been a member of the GAA since I was 8 years of age. As a child growing up in England, as an Irish child growing up in England, it was fundamental to my identity. I remember the first day I walked into Blenheim Avenue to play for Finbars on a Sunday morning to go down for training, and felt like I was at home. And I played for St Finbars for years after that. I've footballed, I've hurled, I've coached both. I coached the under-16 county development squad at hurling for a year or two. Yeah, the GAA is a huge part of my life. There's no point saying it's not. I mean, I have recognition for all sports. I love rugby as well. I think anybody that plays sport, there's a great thing for the mental health and the physical health in sport.
And obviously, on your own training, you're involved in the triathlon world.
And I've done 4 triathlons in my life, Kieran, but 2 of them happened to have been Ironmen, so yeah, done a bit.
How did you get into triathlons?
I used to do a couple of the adventure races, like Gale Force and those ones up here, and then in 2015, in October, I was knocked off my bike by a car, and I ended up with titanium in my shoulder and left arm and 13 pins in my arm. And the surgeon in Galway told me I'd have to register as handicapped. And I broke down in tears in his office. I got really, really angry and decided that I wasn't going to accept that. He told me I'd be allowed to swim 2 lengths of the pool a day, but nothing more than that. So I kind of got a bit thick, to be honest with you. I went through a serious physiotherapy program up here in Remelton Community Hospital, and then I went out to Adam Spears' gym in New Mills in Letterkenny, and I remember lying on the floor and put my shoulder back, and I said, that's as far as I could go. And Adam says, let me see how far it goes if I put a weight in it. And I realised. And then after that, I decided I'd run the Dublin Marathon.
What year was that, Tom?
I ran the Dublin Marathon 2016, and then kind of potted around at the gym, keeping fit, and then I met a few fellow lunatics who'd done an Ironman or two, and I went, I wonder what one of them's like. So I'll be honest with you, one evening, probably when myself and John Jemison had keeping each other company on a Saturday evening, I got out the credit card and I registered for Ironman Barcelona, and I sent Adam a text saying, I've just registered for this, hoping he would send me back a text saying, cop yourself on, not a hope. But he sent me a text saying, no bother, lad, I'll have you ready. And that was it.
You enjoyed the training, I'm sure, and the experience of competing out there?
I loved the experience of competing out there. The training, yeah, it's great. You're a great bunch of lads with your training, lads and women, and the triathlon club, you know yourself, you're involved. There's great camaraderie down there. Yeah, sometimes the 5 and 6 hour bikes on a Saturday and then again on a Sunday can be a bit challenging when you're coming close to an Ironman, but for most of the year it's a lot less than that. It's great crack. It's great for the head. If you're having a bad day and you get on a bike and you cycle for 3 or 4 hours. I remember one of the days when I was training for Barcelona, I was out on my own and I'd cycled from Remelton. I'd gone past Limavady and I was going on to, I can't remember the next town after, and I remember facing up a hill and it was absolutely freezing cold and it was lashing rain, and I just said to myself, what in the name of God are you doing? You're 3 hours away from home. It was about, at that stage, it was about 9:30 on a Saturday morning. I'd left home before 6 o'clock, cycled out, and I just remember pulling up at the top of this hill, and if a taxi had come past, I would have threw the bike into the hedge and got a taxi home. But do you know, I finished it and I came back, and then, yeah, do you know what? For 10 minutes after you finish an Ironman, before the pain sets in, it's a great feeling.
No competition, obviously, last year, and the possibility of competition coming up this year. How hard is that to sort of stay motivated?
Very, very hard. We're lucky that we have a fairly good training group together. So we text each other, we ring each other, we see how you're getting on, we motivate each other. There's a lot of online classes from the gym. So, in fairness to Adam, he puts a good service there. So I think he does 10 classes a week that you can pick out. I certainly don't do that many of them. But, you know, I do a lot of riding on the turbo, sitting, and thank God for Netflix, stick on a film or two, and pedal the legs for as hard as you can. And yeah, sometimes it's hard to keep motivated. It's, the weighing scales can keep you fairly motivated too, you know, especially around Christmas time. But yeah, it's, you know, there's challenges, but you always feel better after you've exercised, as you probably know better than anybody else I'm ever going to talk to, Kieran.
Finally, if you could give Tom Murray advice when he was 21, what would that be?
Back yourself, but recognise the value of others earlier and align yourself with people who are better at things than you. But also, I would have, when I was a young fella, really, really struggled with self-confidence. And to some degree, I still have issues with that now. And I try to hide that often through arrogance or humour. I think I probably would have told myself to have a bit more self-confidence and back yourself. And if you believe in something, do it. And, you know, if you're doing something you love and if you're doing something you're happy in, it's not about always pursuing figures. Sometimes it's about pursuing something you enjoy and you're happy in.
Tom Murray,
and,
Murray Farmers of Chain.
I think try to avoid negativity in life. Kieran. Try to avoid negative people and try to avoid negativity within yourself. Sometimes being in business on your own can be a really, really lonely place. You can't talk to your competitors because they're your competitors, so you can't in any way show that you're feeling down or weak. So you tend to become quite introverted in your own head about your own problems. And I think find a way to surround yourself with family, friends who are positive influences and stay in a positivity bubble because it makes it so much easier.
Tom Murray from the Murray Pharmacy Chain, thanks for joining us on Business Matters.
That's it for another edition of Business Matters. I'd like to thank my guest, Tom Murray. Thanks to Kenneth Wilson on sound. And thanks to you for listening. If you'd like to get in touch with the programme, drop an email to businessmatters@highlandradio.com.
Business Matters, in association with Donegal ETBs for their education and training service, developing the Donegal workforce in one of the most critical and fundamental digital skills of our time through its spreadsheet programmes.